This is Lauren Collier. Thank you for listening to the Idea Accelerator podcast and for your interest in business and entrepreneurship in the Colorado Springs community. Funding is provided by Live Dream Colorado. Live Dream Colorado is my business born out of a need I saw in the local marketplace. I believe that everyone has the right to service-oriented, expert residential real estate services. If you enjoy this show, consider checking us out when you start thinking about buying or selling property in the Colorado Springs region. We love to answer questions from first-time homebuyers, investors, and potential home sellers. We simply love helping people with their real estate process. Because we believe in giving back, we pledge to donate a portion of all our firm's proceeds to support Trails and Open Space Coalition. And we also support schools by donating to the school of every teacher client we serve. We fund the production of this show with a mission to help Colorado Springs business owners and aspiring business owners live up to their greatest potential and achieve their dreams. You can learn more on our website, livedreamcolorado.com. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/livedreamcolorado or call me anytime with your real estate related questions at 719-272-1765. Now, on with the show. Enjoy. Welcome to the Idea Accelerator podcast of Colorado Springs, where we learn from amazing experts across all fields of interest, their shortcuts and strategies for succeeding in business in Colorado Springs and beyond. I'm your host, Lauren Collier. Today's featured thought leader obtained a bachelor's degree in nutrition science at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, in addition to a degree in business administration from the University of Arizona. She worked with longtime colleagues to open a first-of-its-kind adult intensive outpatient program in Colorado Springs. She established nutrition course content for a 9-month sober living community and day program, including designing hands-on cooking classes for men's and women's programs to improve outcomes in early recovery. She now operates a private practice offering assessments, medical nutrition therapy, and nutrition care plans to adults with multiple medical conditions, risk factors, and comorbidities. Please welcome registered dietitian and owner of Peak Nutrition, Martha Rosenau. Hi, Martha. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being on today.
Lauren, thank you for having me.
This is great. You have been in business in Colorado Springs for a really long time, and I reviewed your resume, and it seems like you do a little bit of everything. But give us a brief overview of your work.
So I have been in business quite a while, and it starts to feel also like I've lived in Colorado Springs forever, and it's because I've lived here longer than I've lived anywhere else, and it truly feels like home. In terms of my having my hands in a lot of different things, that's simply because things tend to fall in my lap. And whenever people reach out to me and say, would you like to be a part of this? I say yes for 12 years now. Saying yes.
That will keep you really busy.
Occasionally I have to say no as a result of that.
Your primary place you spend your day is at your private practice. Is that right?
Yes, and it's always been right in the heart of the downtown. At one time, it was in the part of the downtown that's now booming over by Coquette's new location. So I was next door to Coquette's originally. Now I am closer to Cottonwood Center for the Arts, if that helps people in terms of visualizing the part of the downtown I'm presently in.
Where's your location?
My location is 4 South Wasatch Avenue. That's at the intersection of Pikes Peak. So major intersection.
And what do you do there?
So I see patients. And other than that, I used to conduct television interviews right in my office. So I was a regular guest on the 5 a.m. news for NBC for many, many years. And so in addition to seeing patients in my office, I also conducted television interviews concerning food and nutrition. And sometimes we would take it offsite and we would like have it be live inside of Whole Foods or different things like that. And so I guess you could say more things have gone down in my office over the years than just seeing patients. Mm-hmm. So I specialize in gastrointestinal disease. So as a result of that, the types of concerns that people have are either upper or lower gastrointestinal issues. And that's an awfully big word that just means esophagus, stomach, intestines. For those that term didn't mean anything. And then there's a smattering of people coming to see me for a variety of other medical conditions, but predominantly people have either a need for weight management or they have a GI issue. And GI is an abbreviation for gastrointestinal. I don't want to do medical speak here.
Right. For those who don't know you, are you a doctor per se?
So doctors are a different type of medical provider. Dietitians are just called dietitians, but often when the public calls me on the phone, they refer to me as a doctor because they wouldn't necessarily know that. Only psychiatrists and physicians are called doctors. Oh, and osteopaths are called doctors. And wait, I just thought of another one, chiropractors. So it is kind of an all-encompassing term, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. So where do you fall into the picture? Do folks usually start by seeing an MD and then get a referral to you? Do people often start by seeing you for their problems and then sometimes you send them to an MD? How does this work?
They might come see me. I might give them the name of a psychiatrist. They might come see me. I might give them the name of a GI doc. They might come see me. I might give them the name of a primary care because maybe they don't love their primary care physician or they're new to town and they don't have one yet. Otherwise, yes, it flows in the opposite direction where a physician, a psychiatrist, or a therapist has sent me a patient.
I felt it was interesting how one of the first things you mentioned was you might send them to a psychiatrist.
Oh, and I should explain that I also work in a field called behavioral health, which used to be called mental health. And that is because there are forms of disordered eating that show up in weight management that require a larger healthcare team.
If someone comes to you and they're experiencing trouble in, say, their stomach area, maybe their friend just told them that you were great. Like, where do you start? How do you begin to figure out what they might need?
Yes. So it's truly based on their symptoms. And their symptoms speak to me of a diagnosis. I am not going to do the diagnosis, but I know enough of what a cluster of symptoms looks like where I can suspect a diagnosis. Then I right away send them to a GI doc where we get the diagnosis. And then after that, each different GI disease, I'll give some examples, Crohn's, celiac disease, irritable bowel syndrome. Each one of those has their own dietary protocol that is then utilized to treat that set of symptoms. Once you've worked in the field for quite some time, you also know what plan B is. So if the original dietary protocol given didn't produce relief, you immediately change course. Here's something else that's interesting about me, and that always sounds really self-serving. But I just wanted to say, I didn't start out as a dietitian. I started out in the natural products industry. And what that means is I have this long history of having worked both in natural food stores as an educator, meaning as a speaker and a presenter on how to make use of the foods and the dietary supplements within the store. Mm-hmm. That led to meeting people all over the country who either worked for supplement manufacturing or thought leaders in that field. As a result of that, I went on to working in the manufacturer of dietary supplements and herbal products and speaking all throughout North America, including Canada, on the use of those products. All of that occurred before I ever went back to school to become a dietitian. So as a result, here's the second part of my answer on what goes on in your office when someone has gastrointestinal disease. If the dietary protocol alone is not addressing the symptoms to my satisfaction, I then feel out with the patient their comfort level in introducing some natural medicine, also known as integrative medicine, alongside their meds. And I also have references I can use about contraindications and enough wisdom over the years to know what meds can't be used with which dietary supplements or herbal products. And all of that gets shaped into a plan that is Plan B. And the GI docs that I've worked with for more than a decade here in town are familiar enough with me to know that I'm not doing anything to encourage people to not take their meds. It's entirely up to the patient. If the patient says, I won't take meds, that's a different ball game than those who are taking meds. So a lot of it's coming alongside the patient, figuring out their belief system and taking it from there. I push no agenda. I sell no supplements. Mm-hmm.
So you've got me curious now. How did you start in the supplement industry, if that's something that you did prior to earning your credentials to be a dietitian?
Thanks for asking. So I was working in natural food stores in Tucson. Tucson is a natural healing mecca and has been for many decades. I would say that Tucson was a natural healing mecca even in the 1980s. So it was incredibly progressive for the United States. And as a result of where I lived and what everybody's belief system was there, I actually got to meet fascinating people like Andrew Weil before he was even famous. He was just a guy living in Tucson, growing herbs in his backyard, who I got to know. He'd written some books already. He hadn't become like hugely paid on the speaker circuit. He wasn't particularly well known outside of Tucson. And as a result of getting to know him, I was able to be a part of the original University of Arizona Integrative Medicine School and partner with them in my work that I was doing both for natural food stores in Tucson and then later for herbal manufacturers. So because I was meeting the thought leaders in the natural healing industry all across the nation, I got connected beyond Tucson to job opportunities in other parts of the country where I could no longer be in retail and instead be in manufacturing. And I made that leap in 1996 to manufacturing. Once I made the leap to manufacturing, then I actually worked at the plant where the products were produced, and these products are still famous to this day, meaning anyone would recognize the brand name. And we were partnered with Andrew Weil's school at University of Arizona as he was beginning his programs there. And it was a wonderful time to be a part of the dietary supplement industry. It was a fascinating era.
So for those who don't know, who is Andrew Weil, or what's he known for?
Oh, thank you for asking, because I always just assume everybody knows Andrew Weil. So he's a book author, and he's known for being one of the original people in the natural healing industry who became extremely famous and is considered an expert in integrative medicine, and who opened the University of Arizona's Integrative Medicine School, which is considered one of the best in the country other than Duke. So Duke also has a terrific integrative medicine school.
So we haven't had anyone on the show previously to talk about natural healing or natural medicine. And I'm interested in your perspective on it, being that I think there's a really wide range of maybe opinions or responses to those type of phrases like natural healing, from the extent of some people saying that's a bunch of bunk to other people saying that's the only way to go. How do you see that in your practice? How do people tend to respond when you bring that up?
So I don't bring it up. That's what's interesting, is that Colorado Springs is really changing right now. And one of the gifts of having lived here a long time is you get to be a part of how it's changing. And here's how I describe how it's changing. There's a lot of young people raising children now in Colorado Springs. Young people didn't necessarily used to stay in Colorado Springs. And I love it that they find this place attractive now, because they're really shaking the tree and making it far more interesting, especially if you live and work downtown, which I have for many, many years. So the young people who are showing up in my office are frequently telling me, I wouldn't even put my children on a med. That was my clue. Oh, this is somebody I can bring my other wisdom into the mix with. I'm dealing with a person where I wouldn't have any indication that they would be open to even dietary supplements, say, which are pretty benign compared to herbal medicine, then no, I wouldn't be the person bringing it up. Nowadays, something like a probiotic is pretty mainstream, meaning you're not really opening any unique doors with discussing probiotics or fish oil. But if you got into, I guess you could say, more elaborate supplements or into herbs, you might be making somebody very uncomfortable, and I would never want to do that.
To kind of get a sense of what you can do for people, I'm getting the idea that people seek your advice for weight management, and they also seek your advice for general kind of stomach upset. Maybe they can't figure out why it's happening. What percent of the population is having those type of issues? Because I got to tell you, it seems like everybody does. It seems like so prevalent. People having, in many cases, issues with their stomach that they don't even understand, that no one seems to understand. Like, what's going on?
I would have to agree that out of the two things I happen to mention that I specialize in, a broad swath of the population would fall into one of those two categories, and it would occur to them to contact a dietitian. If you had something like high cholesterol or high blood pressure, you might not necessarily think to go to a dietitian. You might say, I'll just take the med. The med manages the symptoms. I'm good to go. It really depends on the person's belief system. But there are plenty of people that show up in my office that say, I don't want to take the med for high cholesterol. I'd rather do it through diet. That was one part of my answer. The next part of my answer is this. Those are the types of people, the people that have weight management issues and those that have stomach upset of some sort or somewhere along the tube. Those are the type of people that are going to think to call a dietitian because they've already made the connection that it's related to food. So there's a certain set of medical concerns where a person's going to clue in to whether or not it's related to food and whether they need a dietitian. Here is a group of people who would also clue in. Those with prediabetes or diabetes. Generally, that population is going to go to what's known as a certified diabetes educator. And it's wonderful that people are aware of that, that there are these people that can help with managing the meds, they can help with managing the diet aspect. I'm always very upfront with people when they contact me and they say they have a blood sugar issue. I say, I'm not a certified diabetes educator, but I'd be happy to help with some aspects. Sometimes they choose to come see me anyway because either they like what I'm all about or their insurance is going to cover it. Otherwise, I'm not trying to take every single patient that's out there, so I don't bill myself as a person who's, I'm a diabetes expert, because I'm not. And if they had kidney disease, I am definitely going to encourage them to go see somebody else. So I'm not a renal dietitian. So I've been really clear since the very beginning about who I should take as a patient and who I should not. Mm-hmm. So the average person with diabetes can certainly come see me. If it's a more advanced case, I'm going to tell them right up front, I'm not necessarily the right person.
I'm really curious, how often are you finding that the symptoms are due to food allergy versus, as you mentioned earlier, something that's more on the psychiatric spectrum versus just stress versus it seems impossible to even figure out.
So I even see small children with gastrointestinal issues, and I've seen small children and infants and teens since the very beginning. So it's not limited to just adults. And lots of small children are reacting to different types of foods. It's not uncommon.
I have heard, and I don't know if this is true, that food sensitivities and food allergies are more prevalent now than they used to be. Is that what you're seeing?
I don't know if that's the case because even when I worked in the natural products industry back in the late 80s, early 90s, lots of people were dealing with these kinds of things in Tucson. So I'm not sure that it's a new phenomenon or that more people have it. I would have to say that behavioral issues appear to be more prevalent than they may have been back in that era in terms of, have I been treating the public in a similar fashion, you know, since the 80s, early 90s? The answer is yes, I just didn't happen to be a dietitian. So I feel like I have many, many decades worth of experience of interacting with the public about their gastrointestinal health and about other medical conditions. Mm-hmm. And I would have to say that behavioral health is exploding in young people and adults in a way that those types of issues were less prevalent then. And as a result of that, yes, I have to be tuned in to different forms of mindfulness and how to help people. And what I mean by that is I have to build a team. I have to have a dynamite psychiatrist who's loving and compassionate. I have to have wonderful therapists that I partner with. And then, as you so knowledgeably pointed out, that could be contributing to gastrointestinal upset. That could also be contributing to disordered eating. So you were right on in everything you said. And because of the type of work I do, I also happen to be able to identify eating disorders. Mm-hmm. So it's a specialized area of dietetics. And when I identify an eating disorder, then I also need to know resources such as higher levels of care to send patients to. So I attend conferences all over the nation. I stay up to date on all the latest research on eating disorders. And it's a fascinating field, behavioral health. Mm-hmm. One of the ways that I stay very, very motivated after all of these decades of assisting the public is that now even substance abuse is considered closely linked to disordered eating. And everything, it appears to come around in a full circle to where you are getting to help more and more people with a broader range of issues that are deeply fascinating and lead to far more caring on my part. And that's simply because people are suffering, and I deeply care about that people are suffering on many different levels.
So how long would a typical client come and see you for? Do they come every week for a year, or do they come once? How does that process look like?
That was great. It really depends on the medical condition. So when it becomes that there's more than one challenge ahead in terms of, is the person dealing with more than one issue, both behavioral health and also a physical ailment, they might be coming for quite longer, and they might be coming weekly. If the person's coming for just a physical ailment, they probably wouldn't come every week except for in the very beginning, and it's because they're hungry for more information and they've been sick for so long that they'd really like to get going as fast as possible. But in terms of who's been with me for years, the type of patient that's been with me for years are those who have issues around weight management, and they need ongoing support and encouragement. And that's why programs like Weight Watchers exist, and that's why Overeaters Anonymous exists, is that people stay with programs that work for them. They need to feel understood and cared about with their struggle without any form of judgment.
So do you refer people to those programs?
Absolutely. Both Overeaters Anonymous and Weight Watchers are dynamite resources to use in addition to having a therapist and seeing a dietitian who's knowledgeable about, well, once again, now we're back to possibly even behavioral health. As often what a person's working with their therapist is underlying issues that have nothing to do with food.
Yeah, like you referenced, people seem to often have weight management issues that are lifelong, like trouble sticking to a diet. You know what I mean? How do you conquer that?
That was great. And it's just because there is this thing known as the dieting mentality. And because it was accepted wisdom probably since the 1950s that people should diet, it's still out there as this belief system that's ingrained in people that they should diet. And in actuality, what research now knows don't work. I just know that it's going to take decades more before the average person embeds that concept in their psyche that dieting doesn't work. And there's actually a whole nother way. So what I'm teaching in my office is an entirely different way, and I'm sure plenty of dietitians are. And that's because even though a person might come in and say, I need to lose 40 pounds by Christmas, I hope there aren't dietitians out there saying, I'll help.
Yeah.
I hope they are far more informed than that.
So I noticed that you use the word weight management as opposed to weight loss. Like, what's going on there?
That was great. So it doesn't mean I wouldn't ever use the term weight loss to describe what people are hoping to achieve. But in the long run, if they could achieve more positive body image and a greater sense of self-worth, regardless of what shape they came in, then they could begin the process of just caring about their health and taking good care of it, which is an entirely different thing than trying to meet the thin ideal, which seems completely unrealistic and totally unfair. And we're seeing more of that in, say, the public eye, that now there are people in television and in movies and in other public arenas where they don't have to meet the thin ideal and they're beloved. And isn't that wonderful that we don't have to just read stories in People magazine about how much weight did they lose or how much have they regained, but instead we could just read about them as a human being and a person who is in the media. And so things are changing. And here's a really good example. There's a hero in the magazine called Runner's World, and her name's Myrna, I believe. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing it, and instead it's Myrna. But Myrna is a ultra runner who does not meet the thin ideal. And she was interviewed in Runner's World and has now got sponsors to where she's in advertising in Runner's World. And she's a hero to lots of runners because she loves running just as much as anybody else, and she's out there doing it, and she's out there inspiring other people who don't meet the thin ideal to just move their bodies. And it's just a really wonderful thing to see. It's inspiring in every way. It's the opposite of the Biggest Loser. It's the Band-Aid and the salve to what got created by the Biggest Loser.
Yeah, didn't the Biggest Loser get out of control?
Yeah, I would have to say, I'm sorry that show ever came about. It perpetuated the dieting mentality.
Yeah, I gotta say, it wasn't something that I watched on a regular basis, but I happened to catch some anniversary show, 5th or 10th or something, and they took all the winners or participants over the last few years and continued to challenge them to lose more and sort of like reweighed them, and whoever had lost the most total weight over this time period was the winner. And I mean, as you went down the line, like, it seems very healthy in the beginning that you're going from a very unhealthy high weight to somebody a little more fit and spending time taking care of your body and eating right and exercising. And then they go slingshot so far in the other direction that people were emaciated. I mean, they couldn't possibly have been healthy, the ones that won as the quote Biggest Loser, because they were measuring only by one criteria.
I think it's fantastic that you just encapsulated this so perfectly in terms of, I actually didn't get to see that. It's regrettable that I didn't. I probably would have really benefited from seeing that episode. But I have seen research that's truly fascinating. They followed the people that had lost the most weight on The Biggest Loser, and they followed them for 5 years after they were no longer on the show. And in this piece of research, what they found, those that had lost the weight on the show had regained it plus more And so now they were 5 years later dealing with an even higher weight than they'd ever been at in the first place. And so they studied them at the biochemical level to figure out what's going on in these people's bodies. Why would they weigh more now than they even originally did when they went on The Biggest Loser and lost so much weight? And what they found out is that when you starve yourself, which is exactly what that show is encouraging people to do, it's just not shown up front in terms of what goes on behind the scenes. But when the body goes through a state of starvation, the metabolism drops so low that it never goes back to the metabolism that they originally had when they came on the show. So they may have embodied a larger physique, but yet they had a perfectly functioning metabolism. Now, after the show, weighing less, they have a poorly functioning metabolism where now their caloric needs are significantly lower than they ever were before. And here's a person now without all the supervision, without all the support and encouragement and assistance day to day. And how would they know that they need even fewer calories than what they needed on the show? They would have no way of knowing that. So they would be following the protocol of whatever they've been given on the show and doing the best they can without all that support, and then left adrift to where, okay, now you have this insanely low metabolism and work with that. So that was a wonderful piece of research that truly demonstrated that there was probably a middle ground that could have been used that really just had to do with finding out what form of movement would feel good to their body and not get them injured, and something they might enjoy. So exposing them to different forms of movement, and then also teaching them about changing dietary habits and how to make different foods than what their palate might be used to. Absolutely delicious, because they had the opportunity to do so. They could have easily taught cooking classes on site and got people really, really excited about new foods served in different ways, even if they'd never eaten them before. And all of those things would have been hugely worthwhile, regardless of whether the people lost weight or not. That was never the issue. And the other thing that research shows is just losing 10% of your present body weight puts you in terrific health, regardless of what the starting number was. And often that's motivating alone. Once the person takes off that amount, then they just keep going. They wouldn't stop doing the things they had been doing because they were never asked to suddenly become a thin person.
I liked how you mentioned metabolism and brought that into it. Can we address that briefly? Do you have any tips or strategies that are applicable people could try and use to... They use the word often in articles I've seen, jumpstart your metabolism, to help you bring your metabolism back up.
So it doesn't mean that a person has a sluggish metabolism just because they embody a different physique. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means they may have never found a physical activity that they enjoy. They may never have acclimated their palate to different foods. What I've seen in the last two generations is that people were raised in households where no one cooked. Families did not sit down at the dinner table and all share a meal. So if you've never been exposed to that ever, you're going to become an adult that doesn't know how to cook and that doesn't make food. As a result of that, people's palates are shrinking in terms of what they've been exposed to. And since I work hands-on with the public, I feel like I have a strong sense of what trends are. And it doesn't mean I don't read research too, that people aren't sitting down together as a family. But in households where families do sit down together and share a meal, and fruits and vegetables show up on the table day after day, things like whole grains and legumes show up on the table and they're not foreign foods, people's palate becomes much broader. And they leave home and they actually know how to work with those foods, or they're at least curious about them, even if they didn't hang out in the kitchen with their parents. So that sets a different tone. And the reason I'm bringing up in terms of discussion on metabolism is that really what it's about is getting a person interested in either the dietary change aspect or in the moving their body aspect. And either one of those things would impact metabolism, and here's why. Not all foods are metabolized equally. It's not just total calories. It's not just counting calories. So once again, more parts of the dieting myth, which is that it's just calories in and calories out. It's actually not true. It's the food choices. So there's that too.
Can you elaborate with an example or two of some of the foods that you're thinking of?
Yeah. So for instance, more of a plant-based diet. And so I was kind of throwing a few out in terms of fruits and veggies, whole grains, legumes, and how to work with those foods, because that would be a complete mystery to most people as to how to work with those foods and create meals using those foods. So since I'm not mentioning more common foods that people might be putting together a meal utilizing, my point was simply that once a person does know how to work with those foods, then if those are the main fuels going into the body's now receiving far more fiber, far more variety of individual nutrients, and the person's getting full a lot faster on less calories. So that spoke to metabolism right there. But so does increasing fiber in the diet and displacing foods that don't metabolize well. So it's not just about what you do put on your plate. It's also what you didn't, because you put the other things on there instead.
Right. I like that. That's a nice way to say it.
Yeah.
So I'd like to ask you a question, because it's something that has been in the media a lot lately, which is in regard to intermittent fasting. What do you think about timing of meals? Does intermittent fasting have a place? Is that an important component of what you recommend for weight management?
So in terms of weight management, I'm going to separate that topic for a moment and just talk about extending lifespan. There is research that shows that consuming one less meal per day leads to a longer lifespan. So that can't be disputed, that if a person only, say, ate 2 out of 3 meals in a day, that there is research and support that that extends lifespan. Does everyone want to do that? Only eat 2 meals in a day? I'm not sure. But more importantly, research exists that supports that. So there might be people out there that would say, all I care about is living to 120. I've got to. And it becomes like this competitive thing of, I'm going to outlive everyone. And I'm going to feel terrific the entire time. So for those people, they might really get on board with what that research shows, which is there does appear to be a way to extend the lifespan. So you asked about intermittent fasting and its popularity right now. It's not that far off from what I just described, which is intermittent fasting would imply that, no, they're not eating for as many hours per day as somebody else. So they're probably only getting in 2 meals worth of food. Unless they're stuffing themselves in the window where they were told, oh, go ahead and eat in that window. It's going to miraculously do something that in this other window it wouldn't, because you'd be more sedentary then, which I would say, I don't know, who's the person? What hours do they keep? Because some people might be completely sedentary until 10 in the morning because they're still in bed. And that would embody young people in most cases, although it might also be people who like to stargaze at night or who might like to go to see live music shows who are not necessarily young people. So there's no one right way to build your schedule for the day. My point was simply that intermittent fasting was not that different than what the research showed about, I guess you could just call it caloric restriction, meaning 2 meals a day versus 3, which is different than starvation, I just want to point out, meaning caloric restriction is not the same thing as starvation.
Are there other myths about health and eating and diet that you would like to correct while we have the time on the show?
It's a very interesting question. I try to wade cautiously in this terrain and not call any one thing out. But why don't you mention another thing that's popular right now other than intermittent fasting?
Okay, I would say right now the other most popular things that I hear the most about are paleo diets and ketogenic diets.
Okay, so we'll take paleo first. Paleo still includes some amount of carbohydrate within it. And that's because somebody decided that sweet potatoes were in some way different than any other form of carbohydrate. And so there you have it. Somebody made that decision. And they also decided that early men ate sweet potatoes. And I would say, depends on which part of the planet they were on. That was really all I had to say on the differentiation between paleo and the keto diet, because the keto diet would imply that the person might not be eating any carbohydrate whatsoever. And it's been shown to reduce seizures. So there is certain medical conditions where people are given the ketogenic diet. There's also conditions that people are born with where the ketogenic diet appears to work. So these are very, very rare conditions where this diet is utilized. But now it's, I guess you could say, being popularized for other things. And another thing that's being popularized is only eating like 20 grams of carbohydrate in an entire day, because it'll lead to weight loss. One of the things I always start out with when a patient says, I want to do the such and such method, is I say, does it sound practical for life? Because if it doesn't sound practical for life, and it's going to limit their ability to socialize and be a part of all the really wonderful parts of community, I would say they might want to reconsider. But doing anything short term may not be the best approach, because what happens with people who have been weight cycling ever since childhood is that they're dealing with a really high state of frustration. Like you said earlier, they were able to do something for a while and they weren't able to stick with it. And so they are very, very hard on themselves about the fact that they weren't able to stick with it. My impression is what they chose wasn't the right plan for them, because had it been the right plan for them, then they might have been able to stick with it. And I don't want anyone to feel like they're failing or that they needed to do something differently prior to landing in my office. It's really about an exploration of what's doable and can you accept that you may not be in a place where you're ready to take on more. And could that just be okay? That you're not doing what's happening on, say, The Biggest Loser. Would it be okay? So when I find out from a person what it is they'd like to do, sometimes they really, really want to go do it. I have learned that trying to stop them or discourage them from something that they really want to go do is never going to work. They're not going to want to work with me. If the whole goal is for me to build connection with somebody, I need to find out why it's so important and then wait for the opportunity to provide input, but not volunteer it. So I'm not in my office saying, "Don't do that. That's nutty. Do this." Because then the person doesn't feel heard. It would be like me saying, "Don't take your meds."
So I want to bring up one other that came to me, which is gluten has become a really big deal. And my understanding is that there's a small percentage of the population who are genuinely very allergic to gluten. There might be another larger population who are sensitive to it. And for a huge portion of people, it probably doesn't actually matter. And the question I'm really curious to know is reducing or eliminating gluten from a diet generally an applicable good practice for everyone? Is that something that should matter for most people?
So people with gastrointestinal issues might have already pulled it before they came to my office. If they saw relief, I'm certainly not going to say stick it back in. But I am going to wait for the opportunity when the time is right to educate them on the nutrient gap between when they used to be a wheat eater and the types of products they're presently purchasing, because the gluten-free products are entirely lacking in nutrition. Mm. So living on gluten-free products is not a win, not for weight management. It's not a win for long-term health. It's basically, wow. and high fat content. So it's not that a person transitions to not being a consumer of wheat, whether that was in the whole wheat version or whether that was in the refined wheat version, and then suddenly now they're eating intensely nutritious whole grains. That's not the transition that gets made. But it is a teaching moment for me when the time's right of how to close that nutritional gap.
So what type of nutrients are in those gluten-containing products that people end up missing out on?
Great question.
What's good about gluten products?
The whole wheat was loaded with fiber, vitamin E, and lots of B vitamins. So whole wheat was this incredibly nutrient-dense food. What's missing in the gluten-free products in most cases is any amount of fiber whatsoever and any individual nutrients. So they would have to find them from other foods or not just rely on quick grabs and instead cook.
Very interesting. Wheat, grains, carbohydrates, they're really getting the short end of the stick lately. So it's kind of interesting to hear what it is that you're missing if you take that stuff out.
Well, and some people would say, I can't tolerate any grain. I've tried. None of them work for me. I would never tell a person it's all in your head. It's not going to help them in any way.
Yeah. I want to get to the portion of the show where we get a little bit of your more general advice. This has been incredibly cool to pick your brain.
Thank you. It's been wonderful for me.
Before we let you go, let's hear a thought or two from you about Colorado Springs. What do you recommend? What's one or two of your favorite things in Colorado Springs that people should check out?
Oh, thank you. So the outdoors, of course, I'm going to advocate for the outdoors, and wherever calls to you. So whichever part of the city that calls to you in terms of outside of, say, where the houses are and into where maybe the you might see a little bit of wildlife, or you might be able to hear birds or have the aroma of plant life, or just see spectacular vistas. Anywhere you can get to and appreciate that, I would say that is what we offer that many other cities in America don't. And it's a real gift to have this much outdoor space that one can go enjoy.
Absolutely.
It's a gift, and it's probably what draws most people to Colorado Springs, that and how warm and friendly everyone is here and welcoming.
And for some, if we have a listener or two right now who would love to do something similar to what you do, they are very passionate about helping other people with their diet and these same type of issues. You started your practice. You've made it very successful. You have a huge client base. What would be your recommendation to someone looking toward that goal in their future? What would be one or two of the things, whether it's a mistake you made in the past and learned from, or a couple of things you happen to do really well that you would pass on?
So I was really lucky. I got to be in the first graduating class of the UCCS Dietetics School, and I've been able to give back to the dietetics community ever since. So students in the program now still work in my office to this day. And I'm also a preceptor, which means interns from around the country also work in my office as a way of becoming dietitians. And so what's terrific about being in Colorado Springs is we have a dietetic school, and so anyone who is interested, of course, has the opportunity to stay here, live here, become a dietitian. No one has to leave. So if I had started 1 year earlier on my path, I wouldn't even have been able to stay in Colorado Springs. I would have had to leave to have become a dietitian. And so we're really blessed. And that's my best answer as to your question, which is, we have a terrific dietetic school, and I'm on an advisory board of that dietetic school, to where we're going to make sure that we remain accredited for time immemorial and that we continue to offer the best education right here locally to anyone who wants to become a dietitian.
Very cool. And for those who would like to reach out to you, contact you, learn more about your practice, what would be the best way for them to do that?
They could call or they could email, either one. My phone number is 548-9859. My email is martha@martharosenau.com. So Rosenau is spelled R-O-S-E-N-A-U. So martha@martharosenau.com.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being on this show. I feel so lucky to have been able to ask you so many questions that have been on my mind and that I'm sure are on other people's minds as well. So thank you so much for your time and all your answers and insight.
It was my pleasure, Lauren.
Thank you for tuning in to the Idea Accelerator podcast of Colorado Springs. I'm your host, Lauren Collier, and I just want to say thank you for tuning in. One more thing before you go. This podcast is now proud to be part of the local podcast conglomerate called Studio 809. Did you know that Studio 809 has many great shows in addition to this one? You can check out other local voices at studio809radio.com. You can also follow Studio 809 on Facebook to get alerts when new podcasts air. And check out the many great local podcasts by following Studio 809 on Twitter, too.